Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Barbara Hamley. More than 3,500 babies in the U.S. die suddenly and unexpectedly every year while sleeping, often due to sudden infant death syndrome or accidental deaths from suffocation or strangulation. This week, the American Academy of Pediatrics released new guidelines on the best way for your baby to sleep. And those guidelines are of particular importance to parents of newborns in Hampton Roads. Sadly, our region has the highest rate of infant death in the Commonwealth. How and where your baby sleeps matters. And we'll talk about it next on Another View on Health, right after this news from NPR.
Discussing today's topics from an African-American perspective, this is Another View.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Another View. I'm Barbara Hamley. First, a very, very special thank you to everyone who joined the WHRV family in support of Another View last week with our fall membership drive. We met our match and some, and so we really appreciate all of your support. So thank you so much for joining us. And I also want to say a special hello to a group of journalists from Russia. Let's see if I get this right, Yaroslavl, Russia. And they are here with us here at WHRO, WHRV today to learn about American journalism and to also share some information from their countries. And I tell you, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce their names. In fact, I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves individually. So if we could go ahead and get started.
Hello, my name is Alexei Tsirkov.
Hello, Alex.
Mikhail Kantoyev.
Hello, Mikhail.
Vladislava Kuimova.
Very nice to meet you.
Hello, Norfolk. I'm Sergei Grubushkov. I'm Russian TV anchor.
Fantastic. And
Andrei Alexeyev.
Hello.
Firmikova.
And you are the facilitator, correct? Fantastic. Well, welcome all of you to Another View, and we appreciate you all being here with us today. Thank you so much. So here's the question. Back or stomach, pillow or not, crib bumpers, yes or no, in your bed or in a bassinet? And does any of this matter? The answer is yes. Where and how your baby sleeps could make the difference between growing up healthy or falling prey to sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. The Hampton Roads region has the highest rate of infant death in all of Virginia. But there are things we can do to bring that rate down. We have a stellar panel of experts to give us some advice. Please welcome back to Another View, Dr. Michelle Clayton, pediatrician with CHKD, specializing in child abuse. Dr. Clayton, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We're so happy to have you back. Mina Tamaklov, a maternal and child public health nurse with the Hampton Health Department. Hi, Mina. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Sean Ware Avant, a licensed professional counselor and project coordinator for the Virginia Healthy Start Initiative. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks so much for being with us. And always my co-host for Another View on Health, cardiologist Dr. Keith Newby. What's happening?
Same old, same old. It's always running crazy. But we're here.
We are here. We are here. And actually, October is SIDS Month, right? Mm-hmm. National SIDS Month. And we wanted to talk about this on a couple of levels. One, because of what the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with their guidelines this week, but also some special work that you ladies are doing within the Hampton Roads region to try to improve the situation. So I'm going to start with you, Dr. Clayton. What is SIDS exactly? And what do we know now about it that we haven't known in the past?
Truly, SIDS is a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that there can't be any other medical condition or condition with the sleep situation in which an infant was found deceased to account for their death. Mm-hmm. And so true SIDS is actually quite rare. What children are more often dying of is sudden unexplained infant death, or SUID. And that is when an infant is found in an unsafe sleeping condition, such as in their parent's bed or on top of soft bedding, or wedged into a cushion of a sofa or chair. And that if there's a condition like such as that which leads to suspicion for a suffocation or strangulation, then SUID is actually a lot more common than true SIDS.
Mm, okay. So why is it, Sean, so high in the Hampton Roads area?
Well, we don't have any real answers about that, but there's a lot of concern, especially in Norfolk. In Norfolk, the infant mortality rate is 12.7, which is double the state rate, which is 6.9, just in the city of Norfolk. Mm-hmm. So if
that means per 1,000?
Per 1,000 births.
Is that
correct.
Right?
Okay. Yeah. So if babies are the canary in the cave, so to speak, then we have to look at what are the conditions in the city of Norfolk that would create such a high level of infant mortality. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at that. We're trying to figure out, you know, what kinds of social indicators there may be within the homes and within the communities that may be contributing to the high mortality rate.
So, Mina, is this does race or socioeconomic conditions have anything to do with these high incidences?
Well, with SIDS, I would say SIDS can happen to any. It does not really matter your socioeconomic background. It can happen to anybody. So the reason is having a safe sleep, you know, condition, safe sleep environment. If you don't have that, then that will result in SIDS. So again, it does not matter what your background is.
Okay. So it's just, it's a matter of how you take care of your child. And where you place them and so forth. Okay. So let's talk about the recommendations that came out this week. There were a couple that were a little different. One is that you must put your child in on his or her back on a firm surface. Is that correct, Dr. Clayton?
Yes, absolutely. Soft bedding is something that an infant can sink into. A lot of people think that soft bedding is necessary for a child's comfort, but a firm surface that the child can't sink into is far, far safer. Mm-hmm. Because if an infant is placed on soft bedding like a pillow and sinks into the pillow, then the pillow can suffocate them. They don't have the ability to turn their head out away from the pillow or the neurologic mechanisms to wake up recognizing that they're short on oxygen.
That's interesting. So, and it doesn't even have to cover their face like completely in order to cause that suffocation, does it?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right. Now, one that I found interesting was that, Sean, they were saying that you should not use baby monitors. You know, I thought that was kind of the way to help people figure out if something was going on with their child. Why is that?
I imagine the reason would be because it sort of serves as a placebo and people tend to let down their guard. So they feel like if the monitor's in the room or if it's in the crib with the baby, that I don't have to check as often. So by not having the monitor there, it kind of prompts parents to go in and look or to get up and check, even if the baby is not crying, to be sure that they're okay. Mm-hmm.
I guess in a way, it seems to me that the recommendation should not necessarily be to not have it. I know when our youngest child, I mean, that was a help to me in that my wife and I were pretty diligent with the checking anyway, but it was helpful on those off times if you're, like, say, if you're cooking or doing something in the kitchen and you just want to make sure you know that you're listening out at the same time. Short of just having a baby with you wherever you are, but you do want them to be able to, you know, you make a bunch of noise in the room. We always love that time we get to ourselves. But I'm surprised to hear they would say they don't recommend it at all based on that. So that's what these new recommendations.
Yeah, the new recommendation says to not have the baby monitors. Go ahead, Mina.
Well, actually, I think it's talking about not depending on it.
Right.
It will definitely not reduce the risk of SIDS.
Yeah, that's what I would think.
Just like you said, it will serve other purposes, but you cannot depend on it as the way to reduce the risk of SIDS.
I got you. Okay. Well, one of the other recommendations is that you actually sleep with the baby in the same room for the first year.
Yes.
And I started laughing thinking about my grandmother, my mother, you know, and what the generations tell you about raising children. That's not necessarily what they said. How does that help? And does that mean sleeping in the same bed?
Excellent question. Sleeping in the same bed is absolutely not safe. For a variety of reasons, but primarily because a baby can suffocate on the bedding in the adult bed, you know, have their face pressed against the comforters, the pillows, and unfortunately also the baby can be rolled over onto by the adults. And a lot of adults think, oh, if I have the baby in bed, I'll be able to keep him or her safe, I'll wake up. But anyone who has a little baby knows you are utterly exhausted. You often fall asleep unintentionally, mm-hmm. and you may not wake up when you roll over onto your baby. And so mm-hmm. for a variety of reasons, sleeping in the same bed is absolutely unsafe for babies. However, having the baby in your room, in their own crib, or in their own bassinet is shown to reduce the risk of SIDS and SUID mm-hmm. and facilitates a parent being able to get up and check on their baby frequently. You know, so that may have something to do with the decrease in the rates. I don't know if you guys had any more comments on that.
And I imagine having the baby in the room with you provides a level of comfort that will allow the parent to rest better.
Yes.
Because the baby is nearby, you know, those parents who, you know, sort of want to bring the baby to bed, and a lot of them do it because of sleep. Mm-hmm. And thinking, you know, if I have the baby with me, I can get more sleep, or the baby will sleep more soundly. Not really taken fully into consideration how exhausting raising a small child can be and how, you know, you get into that deep, deep, deep sleep. Mm-hmm. And you may not wake up, but maybe having the baby close by in the bassinet, you know, where you can even, you know, I've said this to clients all the time, just put your hand in the bassinet, or, you know, you can still stroke the baby right there, right up
put
against
it right
the bed.
Right up against your bed.
Yeah, right up right. against the bed. You can stroke the baby right there and, you know, and comfort the baby. It's just a much safer setup for both the parent and the child.
440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers to call to join our conversation. We're talking about safe sleeping habits for infants. And we, since we have such a stellar panel of experts on infant care, if you have other questions, also give us a call. 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. So I noticed on the list that breastfeeding was recommended. I'll start with you, Mina. Why is that a potential deterrent to SIDS?
So it's been determined, according to research, that breastfeeding actually reduced the risk of SIDS by 70%. So that's from the new wow. recommendations that came out. It reduces the risk by 70%. So, which is, I mean, very, it's a good risk, I mean, way to reduce the risk. Mm-hmm. However, I honestly do not know why it is. Mm-hmm. We don't specifically have a reason for it, but it's been determined that breastfeeding definitely helps reduce the risk.
One of the things mm-hmm. I know just with that is just the components of breast milk versus, you know, the standard milk. You talk about the immune products that are done, which would kind of lead me to believe, though, that SIDS, even though I know they don't really know what the cause is, but the scientist in you is going to always say, well, if that's the case, then that means there's something that, you know, the cause of SIDS has to be somehow related to, you know, something that the breast milk has that prevents that from occurring. And again, mm-hmm. I have never actually looked at what all the components are, but just hearing that, I didn't know it was 70%.
That's
pretty
huge.
Pretty huge number. Yeah. So that's telling me it has to be something involved with that that's in the breast milk that's doing that. And again, I know they always said it was better based on just the immune responses and things that mm-hmm. helps the baby fight more infection and things of that nature, but whatever else may be, but I didn't know that myself. That's pretty profound number, 70%. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's sparking my interest now to read up on this a little bit more. But although I'm past the, well past the stage of having any more children.
That's
but,
okay. You got grandchildren coming
that's right.
one day.
That's right.
We
that's
had this
right.
conversation beforehand. So.
We did.
Well, Dr. Clayton, is there anything that pediatricians are finding in terms of the breast milk? And I mean, what is your take on why it's important?
It's unclear exactly why, you know, just like Mina said, it's unclear exactly why breastfeeding results in such a reduction in the SIDS and SUID rate, but it's clear that it has a strong association, a strong preventive effect. Mm-hmm. And it's just speculation, but people wonder if it's not, you know, the kind of wakefulness of the baby, because breastfed babies tend to wake up more during the night for feeding because breast milk doesn't fill you up as long.
Yes.
You know, or is there something, you know, some vigilance on the part of the parent because they know the baby's going to be waking up?
Right.
It's hard to know, but it's very important for people to understand that breastfeeding doesn't entirely prevent sleep-related deaths, because unfortunately there have been cases, although rarer, of a breastfeeding mom having a baby suffocate while she is feeding the baby in the middle of the night, you know, especially if they fall asleep on a couch or in a chair.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just sort of, you know, co-sign to what Dr. Clayton is saying. As a behavioralist, I think that is a part of it, is that breastfeeding moms, because Dr. Newby's not going to be breastfeeding.
but breastfeeding
mothers are going to be more alert because the baby is up more often. You know, you are less likely to have a situation where a parent, you know, has this habit of propping the baby up with a bottle. You know, their habits and the way they learn to, you know, sort of monitor and care for the baby is going to be a lot different because they are the source of the child's nutrition. And so they're going to be more alert, I would, you know, I would imagine. Yeah.
Is breastfeeding culturally, particularly for the African American community, is it a yes or no these days? I mean, my daughter is 34 now, so it was a long time ago, you know, when I did it. But culturally, is it acceptable?
Well, I would say it's a mix. Now, my program works primarily with vulnerable families, and a lot of those families are in situations where their work environments or their work situations don't allow them. There's not a lot of support because a lot of them are sort of groomed to formula feed very early on for that same reason. You know, you're going to need to go back to work and, you know, that kind of thing. And some of them will try. You know, we absolutely encourage that they try. But sometimes, you know, the other factors prevent them from being able to sustain that feeding method for their babies.
Long time, Mina?
Well, I believe it's cultural because from data, we've determined that a lot of African-Americans do not breastfeed compared to Caucasians. Mm-hmm. And most of these moms now, they probably did not grow up seeing their moms breastfeed, so they don't know anything about it. A coworker was sharing with me how she was breastfeeding. I mean, she was holding her baby at a friend's house, and the friend's grandmother came in and thought she was breastfeeding and quickly walked out. So I strongly believe that it's cultural, and that's something that, you know, with education, hopefully we're going to turn it around, because breastfeeding, as we said earlier, has a lot of health benefits.
Absolutely. So if we know that breastfeeding is such a critical component in it, positive component to a child's health, societally, you know, we, like you were saying about the workplace not allowing, people, I've been out in public and there may be someone who was completely covered, you know, and so forth, and was being very discreet, but people just freak out about it.
I mean, quite
honestly, it was, that was one of the reasons when I decided to stop, was because of work. It became an issue for other people. So what do we need to do societally to make that change?
I think we're making a lot of steps in the right direction, because there's that Virginia legislation which was enacted, which makes it illegal to ask a woman to stop breastfeeding in a public place. Hospitals and nurseries are becoming more breastfeeding friendly and being more aware of the needs of the breastfeeding mother and infant. You know, I think we're making a lot of steps in the right direction, but we surely have a long way to go. I think that people need to understand that breast milk is the best milk for a baby. Formulas are based on cow's milk, and cow's milk is great for baby cows.
but it's
not the milk that's formulated for the human infant.
This would be the question I want to pose out, too, but the first one would be the health of the mother as it relates to breast milk. How does that impact? Meaning, if you have someone who, say, may not have the best nutritional makeup in their day-to-day eating, how does that impact on the breast milk's health benefits? Does it impact? Because I would imagine it does in some fashion, but has that ever been looked at before?
Everybody wants to get.
Go ahead, Sean. Let's start with you.
Well,
Sean,
you know, and I have, you know, again, I'm the behavioralist on the panel, you guys, but and so I don't know. I can't speak specifically to research. However, I do know the biggest concern is medications and what types of medications mom is taking and the impact of that on the breast milk. I do also think that, as opposed to the quality of the milk, the quantity of milk is what's most often impacted if mom is not healthy. And, you know, when you have a mom who's not producing enough milk, it's very easy to switch into formula feeding, because the baby's crying. Mm-hmm. The baby's hungry and wants more food. Mm-hmm. So in my opinion, that is the most important thing in terms of keeping moms engaged in breastfeeding, is ensuring that they have the right nutrition, that they continue to take vitamins, even if it's not prenatal.
Just out of curiosity, I'm just going to just throw it out there, because this is what I really get at, is if you have, say, a mother who is a drug user, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, how does that impact? That's really what I was getting at in the end. I just was very diplomatic in asking the question. But if they are, like, say, they're opioid abusers or cocaine users or whatever the case is, how does that impact? Does it impact? Is it just, would that just be impacted on the amount they produce, or would that, in fact, potentially get into the baby?
Yes. Let's go, Mina, and then Dr. Clayton.
So breast milk, actually, whatever the mother takes in goes through the breast milk. So definitely it's going to affect the infant. So if you drink or you smoke or you eat unhealthy, definitely it's going to affect that. So that's what we encourage mothers. If you're breastfeeding, like alcohol, for example, mm-hmm. if you want to breastfeed and drink, it's not a good combination. So we usually recommend that you pump. So if you know you're going to be, you know, you're planning a party that you're going to go to, make sure you pump ahead of time. And so you can use that. Now, if you do drink, you also have to pump and waste it, because it's going to be in the breast milk.
Mm. Dr. Clayton, you want to add anything to that?
Yes. I mean, there really aren't that many health conditions that directly affect an infant's ability to take milk from their mother's breast. So most health conditions and medication management, you know, with good medication management and with careful monitoring of what prescription meds the mom is on, that can minimize the effects on the infant. Overall, the benefits of breast milk usually outweigh the negative effects of what medications the mom may be taking. Now, I am talking about prescription meds.
Right.
So
okay.
if you're okay. talking about illicit drug use, that's certainly something different.
I have one question before we go to the phones. So if a mother is say, abusing cocaine, and as an example, and breastfeeding, is that considered child abuse in the definition of child abuse?
That's a really great question. That's something I'm not sure of off the top of my head. But I know that certainly if somebody is abusing drugs and also breastfeeding their infant, you do have to be worried about what's getting to the baby. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that's certainly something that should be called into Child Protective Services, and they can make a determination from there about whether that violates child abuse statutes.
Mm-hmm. 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Trey joins us. Trey, where are you calling from?
I'm calling on the road. I live in Suffolk Coast.
Oh, okay. Hi. What's your question?
So I have a comment / kind of looking for a response to it. I'm in the medical profession, and I won't really say what I do, but I have I read a study. I guess it's been in the last year, maybe 2 years. And I feel like, and I'm not exactly sure of the exact results of it, but from what I remember, I feel like I read that the study of SIDS was more of a post-mortem diagnosis, that whereas when a baby passes from what they say is SIDS, or even sewage, I guess, that they aren't able to actually diagnose that until they do an autopsy on the baby, seeing as how it was something that they found. I don't know if it was genetics, that was a malformation in the brain or the brain stem or something, but it was something that they found post-mortem after the autopsy, and that it was, I think it was when the baby was rebreathing the carbon dioxide, the brain wasn't able to sense that, and or unable to sense the lack of oxygen to the brain. And I didn't know if that, and I was kind of going over this in my head, and maybe the breast milk, you know, has the essential fats that the baby needs for neurological development. If maybe or maybe not that could be correlated, I'll kind of stop there and let the experts do what they need to do and say what they need to say, because they are the experts. So
okay.
I'll throw that out there, and I'll take a listen on the radio if you guys don't have any questions for me.
Thank you, Trey. We appreciate the phone call. Dr. Clayton, I'll go to you.
All right. So certainly there is still a lot of speculation about what exactly causes SIDS, and the caller was absolutely correct in that SIDS can't be diagnosed until a complete scene investigation and autopsy has been completed on the baby to rule out other medical causes and other environmental causes for the infant death. But and there have been studies in the past showing that it's possible that there may be some neurotransmitters, like some of the chemical signaling methods within the brain and through the nervous system, which may be deficient in babies who do ultimately die of SIDS. But at this time, there's truly not a big body of scientific evidence that tells us one way or another what's happening in the brains of babies who die of SIDS or SUID. So there's clearly much more work that needs to be done. And I liked his speculation that perhaps the breast milk can provide some of those essential components that may enhance their ability to recognize when they're deficient in oxygen or breathing too much carbon dioxide.
Gotcha. Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking about safe sleeping habits for your infant with pediatrician Dr. Michelle Clayton, maternal and child public health nurse Mina Tamaklov. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Parent advocate, educator, and mental health provider Sean Ware Avant, and co-host of Another View on Health, cardiologist Dr. Keith Newby. Before we go to, actually, let's take another call. Alex joins us from Norfolk. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for the pediatrician on the panel.
Sure.
So you all were talking about having a baby not sleep with their mother and talking about how it's good to pump. But what community resources does a mom have that maybe after she's been discharged from the hospital to go get a crib or a bassinet or possibly a breast pump so she can do those things? Is that appropriate to ask the pediatrician? Or are there any community resources that they can easily get access to that can provide these things for mothers?
Alex, everybody is smiling broadly. So you must be asking a question they wanted to get out into the public. Thanks so much for your call. Who wants to start? I'll start with you, Sean.
I can. My program actually is community-based, and that's exactly what we do, is help parents to get linked to community resources like the ones that the caller is asking about. And one, I would absolutely recommend that you check with your insurer, because a lot of the insurance companies will not only provide, but they also cover the charge of pumping equipment for moms.
Oh.
Another thing is that there are lots of community resources for families who qualify for cribs, car seats, for breastfeeding supplies, things like that. You know, one resource I can send folks to right away is Virginia211.org, which lists community resources of all kinds, and you can search. And so if you're not sure, you could certainly do that. But we are always open to helping moms. Our program is perinatal health focused. So if you're prenatal and you want some support, you can certainly get in touch with our program.
And what's the phone number or any email address where they can call?
757.
Website, rather. Excuse me.
757-314-3138.
Okay, and we will put this information also on anotherviewradio.org. You want to add to that?
Absolutely. So with health department, the local health departments, we all have a program, the MCH program, which is maternal and child health. Our program is for moms. So what we have is we provide safe sleep education, and that's what I do. I go to the WIC offices. I open it up to the community to come for education. Other things that we provide is pack and play. So if we determine that a parent or a family is not able to afford a crib, you can get one from the health department. We also provide like little t-shirts, pacifiers, you know, anything like sleep sack, which is what I know parents are worried about. Okay, if you don't want to use a blanket, what if the child gets cold? But we recommend using this wearable blanket. So we give all those.
So a blanket, no blanket in the crib
No
either?
Blanket in the crib either. So it's a sleep sack.
No baby bumpers. Completely bare.
I knew about the
nothing in the
so
crib.
So nothing no wedges, in the crib. No,
no
wedges.
No.
So all those things they taught us in the 70s, out the window.
That's out the window. That's right.
In the 80s, out the window.
So, yeah,
really?
So they can call the health department. You know, call WIC, like Sean was saying, even if you have Medicaid, Medicaid is going to pay for your breast pump. Mm-hmm. Medicaid is going to pay for lactation consultant. So you just call them and find them.
I find what this is interesting is, you know, they don't convey any of this information over when you're in the hospital and, you know, and you're leaving and they give you instructions, but nobody that I've ever seen goes over any of this to let you know there are resources available. It's just probably why that caller asked the question. Mm-hmm. Is there, I mean, have the hospitals been at least amenable to having this information given to the patients as they're leaving? Have you, I'm assuming that connection has been made because, again, I heard nothing about this, these wonderful programs you guys are involved in and running. But when they're leaving the hospital, they don't get that information. They won't even know to even look.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that the three of us on the panel share is we also sit on the Child Fatality Review Team. And part of what we've looked at is how we can work together with hospitals to better educate parents. I think that they do a pretty good job of providing discharge basic information. And a lot of the families do say that they did receive information about safe sleep, but it's not consistent. And
well,
I think
so
that's the challenge.
I'm talking about the other things, like the resources issues.
Yeah.
I've not heard about that at all. They have.
Some don't.
Okay.
So it's the consistency that's the issue. It would be great and it makes sense if all hospitals who have L&D departments, you know, were providing the same kinds of information to all families and doing it consistently.
Yeah.
And then that way we know that families are getting the information they need to make the best choice for their family.
Well, I would assume CHKD does it because it's a children's hospital.
Well, CHKD isn't a birthing hospital.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Oh,
yeah.
It's not a birthing hospital.
No, Sentara Norfolk General Hospital, the hospital next door is where the births happen, right?
I learned something new every day.
They're preemies, or they have to go to, get transported over there, but the actual... where they deliver is actually at Norfolk General.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now, I remember when my granddaughter was born, there was a nurse on the labor and delivery floor who was also certified in car seat installation. And they would not allow us to go until she checked out the car seat. And we also had to bring the car seat in the room and actually put the baby in the car seat to make sure that they were big enough and it was right and, you know, and that you buckled it properly and so forth and so on. So I don't know if any of the hospitals in this area, this was not in this state. So maybe Virginia needs to catch up a little bit. 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers to call. If there's a hospital out there who is doing this in Virginia, give us a call. You know, we'd love to talk to you about it.
I tell you why I keep hammering about this point is if we're talking about the infant mortality rates, if the resources, like example, like cribs or, you know, because, I mean, we don't know in certain situations where these poor kids are sleeping. I mean, you know, they could be in a drawer for all we know. I mean, and if the resources are available, but nobody knows about it, you know, I mean, especially you talk about Medicaid, if they're paying for something, I would almost guarantee most insurance companies, I hope none are listening right now, what I'm about to say, but, you know, a lot of times you'll say, well, they never asked us, so, you know, it's there, but, you know, it's almost like they have it, but they're not going to tell you about it because then if you ask for it,
then you have to pay for it.
You got to pay for it.
440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. So, Stacy, you brought up that all three of you are a part of the Child Fatality Review Team. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that is and what you're trying to accomplish with that team.
So the state of Virginia has a Child Fatality Review Team, and then each region has its own team. And we are a group of community agencies and private providers who are directly working with infant mortality in some capacity, who come together to review all of the infant deaths in our region and to make a determination about whether or not the death was preventable and to come up with recommendations to make to try to prevent deaths in our area.
Mm-hmm. It's actually all child deaths, restricted to infants, but all children die in our region are, you know, any case that's reviewed by the Department of Social Services is reviewed by the Hampton Roads Regional Fatality.
So are you finding any kinds of commonalities in Hampton Roads that is making this number so high here? I mean, what was it? I when I looked on the state records, 158 deaths, I believe, and 118 were in Norfolk by themselves. What's going on?
Certainly, when you talk about infant deaths, and the Child Fatality Review Team sees often 2 to 4 of these deaths every single month, every time we meet. And it's tragic because most of these deaths are preventable. And poverty-related deaths are, you know, a lot of these sleep-related deaths are occurring in conditions where there's a lot of overcrowding in the household. So many, many of these children actually do have a crib and actually do have a pack and play or some other safe place to sleep, but it may not be set up or it may be stuffed with clothing and other items, and so the child is sleeping in the family's bed. Or the child is sleeping in a crib or a bassinet that's full of items, and they, you know, and it's possible that they suffocated. So people need to understand that it's not just that they have a crib. They need to use it, and they need to use it in safe conditions. And if the conditions in their home are so crowded that they can't set it up, then they need to figure out another very safe area for the baby to sleep. For example, people can empty a clothing drawer and have a thin, like, bassinet mattress in there and lay the baby in that. And that's a safe place to sleep.
That firm surface again.
Yes. Separate from the other people sleeping. Yes.
I think another important issue to talk about, though, is that there is a significant race disparity in infant death in Virginia. In 2012, the state in their strategic plan said, you know, we want to work to reduce the not only infant mortality, but also the race disparity. Right now, and I have the numbers, I had to write them down. The national average as of 2013 was 6.2 per 1,000. In Virginia, 6.2. Blacks, 12.2. And whites, 5.2.
Wow.
So the state goal is to reduce the disparity by 2018. Part of what our program is doing is to focus on the African-American community in a community-based capacity. So because we know there are a lot of social indicators, a lot of families won't access the resources that they need. And so we actually go into the communities, into the homes to meet with the moms, to check the sleep environment, to give them advice and recommendations on how to sleep safely with their children, amongst other things that are important to reducing infant mortality. But the highest statistic in terms of infant and toddler deaths is safe sleep. You know, of 14 deaths we reviewed last year, I think 12 were all safe sleep related. So that's our focus.
Wow.
Do they issue on the Norfolk stats? Did they do demographic information, you know, on those individuals, like where they lived in terms of that? I assume that was done. Would you mind sharing?
So is it in lower income neighborhoods?
Absolutely. Okay. The neighborhoods you would anticipate are exactly the target areas. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Tanya joins us from the Eastern Shore. Hi, Tanya. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling and I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Well, I'm a registered nurse and I work with a program here on the Eastern Shore called Nurse Family Partnership. And it's a home visiting program that starts when the mom is pregnant. It is completely free to all residents of Northampton County or Accomack County. And a lot of the information that is being discussed today on the show, we actually provide that in educational sessions to the mom. And I just wanted people to know because it's such great information and people do need to know that this resource does exist.
Tanya, give us a phone number for the people in Eastern Shore, then where they can access your program.
Sure. It is 757-302-4264.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay. And the only thing that they have to do is qualify for WIC services, and they can automatically qualify for this program.
Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate that. So I know that very poor people can get access. People who are in the middle, who still may not know. I mean, are they able to gain, Mina, these same types of services? Is anyone talking to them?
I guess the issue here is access. How do we get to them? Because it's easier for the low income. Maybe we can go to WIC. We find them at places like especially for the home visiting program. Mm-hmm. I know Hampton has the Healthy Families program. Peninsula also has that. Now, how do we access? How do we get to, you know, the people in the middle to provide information? Fortunately for my MCH program, it's open to anybody
who lives
in Hampton.
Yes. Okay.
That's correct. So they can access it. But again, they don't know.
We are still finding ways.
You know, to get, you know, the word out there.
You know, it's really interesting because when you think about public health, I don't necessarily think about mothers and babies. I think about Zika virus and, you know, I mean, things of that nature. So what's the phone number for the Hampton? health department?
So that will be 757-727-1172.
Okay, so those of you who live in the city of Hampton, would go there.
That goes back to the issue I was saying before about those resource issues. If they don't know, that's why I thought it was so important that the hospitals would at least have it accessible as part of their discharge instructions. And again, it may be that way now, but I know I haven't seen that before. But a lot of them are not going to know, to even those that are not listening to this program today, they just won't know. So a lot of it is how you get that information out. And it seems that it's easiest to get it at the source.
At the source. That's true. Right. Let's see. Stacy joins us from Chesapeake. Hi, Stacy. You're on the air.
Hi. How is everyone?
Hi.
Hi. I just have a question. I'm not quite sure if this is the right question to ask because I don't have any concerns about sleep, but I do have some concerns about the baby's health in general.
Okay.
And so I'm an aunt, and my nephew lives in North Carolina, but I believe I have some suspicion of child neglect. What can I do to prevent that or get access to the child's social service person?
Okay, we will let Dr. Clayton answer that question for us.
So,
what does she need to do?
So, the best thing to do is to report your concerns to the Child Protective Services Agency in the county where your nephew lives. And, you know, just give them as much specific information as you can regarding the child's name, where they live, and the basis for your concern. Just describe to them as fully as possible everything you know about the situation that concerns you.
Okay, Stacy. So you'd have to go online, I guess, Google that county. But it should be listed in the government listings.
Yes.
Correct. Thank you so much for that call. Jane joins us from Williamsburg. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been listening to your entire program, and I think it's interesting to hear about the community resources. And I don't expect my comments to be very well received, but I think if you can't afford a crib or a car seat, then maybe you can't afford a child. And I've worked full-time for 38 years, and I raised 3 children and breastfed them while I worked full-time because that was my commitment. And I have paid 100% of everything that my kids needed. And so it's very difficult for me to listen to programs about how, you know, my tax dollars, my donations are going to pay for other people who are not thoughtful about whether they can afford a child, because you don't have to have a child.
Okay,
and I don't have to support your child.
Thank you, Jane.
It's enough for me to support my own.
Thank you, Jane, for your comment, and I will let our panel respond to you.
Well, what I'd like to say about that is, you know, our program, for example, is open to anyone. And it's not just about providing physical resources, because a lot of the families that we work with, they absolutely know how to access what they need. And I think it's important to say that, because parents need more than just items. They also need support. And a lot of times with our program, which is a home visiting program, we'll use incentives to help moms who really are struggling. And the reason they're struggling is not because they aren't capable. It's because they have mental health issues, a lot of trauma, a lot of toxic stress that all of us suffer from. I imagine that this caller, you know, may have also experienced a lot of stress and maybe depression, having to raise all of those kids. And, you know, it happens. And sometimes just having someone to support you is what's needed. And that's a lot of times what these community resources provide. But we also understand that it's not just that. You know, sometimes they do need a little assistance with a crib or something like that. And we'd rather they have that so that the baby is safe and protected than not.
Mina?
Well, I just want to add to what Sean said, that it's not about the incentives, but mainly it's about the education that these moms are receiving. Like I said, I have a program called the Baby Basics Moms Club. It's all over Virginia. And what I do is I provide prenatal education and support. And it's a place where moms come together, and I'm able to get them to get in touch with each other. They're able to call them. I had a mom just moved here. She doesn't have any family, nobody.
And as much of military as we have and so forth, there are a lot of people who don't have family support around them and who need that type of support. Mm-hmm. So that would be available. Dr. Clayton, you're going to get the last word because we're almost out of time. I can't believe this.
I think, you know, parenting is one of the toughest jobs anyone will ever do. And any support that's available to any parent who, you know, has one kid or 5 kids or however many is just a wonderful resource. Mm-hmm. And it's fantastic that these programs are open to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, just quickly, just for that caller, and I hear you loud and clear on that, and I understand how you, why you feel the way you do, but just understand too that we don't always understand people's background, their, how they were raised. Some of these mothers may have been abused as children, and you know, the, their particular ability to deal with this may lead them down these paths of having more kids. It's not really their fault. It's just they were victims of circumstance. So I try my best, although I understand where you're coming from, just understand we don't always know these women's backgrounds and the things they've been through in their life and what may have driven, what may drive them to do some of the things they've done. So just try to be a little bit thoughtful about that.
And we can't. Everyone has a different circumstance.
Exactly.
And so therefore, life is different for each one. So I want to have, we have 3 minutes left, 2 minutes and 30 seconds now. One last thing that you would say, Sean, to parents, to a newborn, parents of newborns in terms of keeping their babies safe.
I would say to be receptive to support. You know, a lot of times moms don't want to ask for help, and that contributes to their stress level, and to be receptive to receiving help and asking for it when you need it.
That's Sean Ware Avant, a licensed professional counselor and project coordinator with Virginia Healthy Start Initiative. Thanks so much. Tamika.
Mina. What I want to say real quick is SIDS, even though it cannot be prevented, it can, the risk can be reduced. So let's make sure, and our parents, make sure your babies are always on their back to sleep. Don't put anything else around the baby. Try and keep these babies safe. And we have a lot of resources. Call the health department. Call home visiting programs for the, okay, you know, the help that's out there.
Mina Tamaklov, a maternal and child public health nurse with the Hampton Health Department. Go, Dr. Clayton.
I just want to remind parents to listen to what their doctors are telling them about safe sleep, and remember that the information from other family members who are of a different generation, those recommendations are outdated. When people say sleep the baby on their stomach, or somebody's like, oh no, babies love a pillow, ignore that. Remember to listen to what your doctor's saying, because your doctor has the most updated recommendations regarding safe sleep.
Dr. Michelle Clayton, pediatrician with CHKD, specializing in child abuse, and you get the last word.
Oh, well, thank you.
I'm
actually okay. I just concur with everybody's statements. I think just listening to your doctor and just, you know, find those resources. Look online, wherever it takes to, if they're there for you, make sure you take advantage of them if they're there.
Absolutely. Right. Thank you all so much for joining us. We appreciate it, and we will be right back.
I'm with Marcellus, and you all are checking out Another View on WHRV 89.5. Don't go anywhere. Check us out.
They always happen to play that one because that's Keith's favorite. He likes the music. For the next 2 weeks, the Virginia Stage Company is putting a new spin on Oliver Twist. The classic Charles Dickens tale is being brought to life by professional actors and students from the Governor's School for the Arts. Full disclosure here, both Lisa Godley and I have ties to the Governor's School. I'm on the board for the GSA Foundation, and Lisa's daughter, Jordan Yowell, is part of the cast. But our connection plays no part in what promises to be an electric adaptation of a vintage novel.
If you're a fan of Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist, there are plenty of lines you'll recognize in the Virginia Stage Company's adaptation.
Oh, dear lady, I would be your serving man, running up and down the whole day long to make you happy. What would I give to do it?
Oh, you shall give nothing at all. You already make us very happy indeed.
How kind of you to say so.
Come on, let's take you in to see Auntie.
Like the original, the play follows Oliver's journey as he searches for his identity. But unlike the classic Dickens tale, the Virginia Stage Company version is music-driven. This electric tale is packed with beautiful imagery and a talented 25-member cast, made up of professional actors and students from the Governor's School for the Arts. The play's visual storyteller, Nefri Amini, loves the enthusiasm and spirit the young actors bring to the VSC production.
First thing you notice when you step into the room for this process is all the young people in the room. So they dominate the cast. They are the majority. And the beautiful part about it is that they bring so much energy and joy.
Amini uses puppetry and engaging scenery to create the perfect background, whether it's a moment where you escape into fantasy or are captivated by the violence.
How can I use beauty in order to get people's hearts to open in that moment so that they can really receive all of the emotions that are coming along with it? The way that we're taking those violent moments and abstracting it enough to where people can really take it in, and they tend to be the most emotive parts of the show. So in a moment where a woman is murdered, instead of like, oh, let's pour gushes of blood, now's the time for the red flowers to flutter down.
13-year-old David Hopkins plays Oliver Twist. David says it's interesting to play a character from a different place and time.
You have to keep in mind that they didn't have the same types of laws that we have now. There weren't like freedom of speech laws all the time, and there weren't like, it's a free country law. We have more freedom to do what you want.
But the young actor likes the fact that the play teaches life lessons.
Even when you have a little bit, when you don't have a lot, you can still make a lot out of a little bit. You can find your destiny. You can find out what you want to do.
Like the original, the production explores what it means to be born into a certain class, how some get trapped in a lifestyle, and how others struggle for a better life.
For me, it's exposing the question of why, to really look behind the scenes and say, how did these circumstances develop? So in this strange way, this show has made me have compassion for even the bad guys in the story. It makes me look deeper into what is a person's history that has caused this.
Asia Bruce, a Governor's School senior, plays Oliver's close friend Rose, and has garnered her own thoughts about classism.
I feel like people like Rose, we have power. And when you have power, you can help someone.
She says she likes that this production gives the students an opportunity to experiment with their other talents.
You will see me dancing. I'm not the best dancer. I'm not the best singer, but I'm having fun. I actually have fun when I'm dancing and when I'm singing with the cast. And we actually sound pretty good. I'm surprised myself. So.
The cast will treat Hampton Roads audiences to 18 performances, running through the second weekend in November.
It's this classical American tale. It's Charles Dickens, it's Oliver Twist, but I have a very particular image in my mind of what that means and who it relates to. And I would say that this is a story to come and see, to make something that's old and classical and only thought of in one way reborn in a way that does relate to everyone.
For Another View, I'm Lisa Godley.
And Oliver Twist debuts tonight at the Roper Theater and runs through November the 13th. Election Day is November the 8th. No excuses. Please vote. The Norfolk branch of the NAACP is once again offering rides to the polls. It's called Souls to the Polls. To schedule a ride, call 757-749-3389. That's 757-749-3389. There's more information on our website, anotherviewradio.org. And open enrollment for healthcare begins November 1st. That's next Tuesday. There's a 2017 Enroll Fest kickoff on Saturday, November the 5th from 10 until noon at the Boo Williams Sportsplex in Hampton. For more information, check out the events section of anotherviewradio.org. Next week on Another View, the Clavel Report. And Eric will be here to discuss critical information for you to consider before you go to the polls. When is Election Day again? November the 8th. So please go vote. We really appreciate you listening to Another View. If you'd like to hear this show again or share it with a friend, please check out our podcast on our website, anotherviewradio.org. You can also go to the WHRO media app and take us with you wherever you go. Our theme music was composed and performed by Jay Sennett. Lisa Godley is our show producer. Victor Bowen is our audio engineer, and Nicholas Thomas answered our phones. I'm Barbara Ham Lee. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. All those Aggies and who are they? The Trojans and the Norfolk State Spartans. And everybody else who's having homecoming. Have a great time this weekend. And we'll get together again next Friday at noon for Another View.